Reveal is brought to you by Progressive. Are you thinking more about how to tighten up your budget these days? Drivers who save by switching to Progressive save over $700 on average, and customers can qualify for an average of 6 discounts when they sign up. A little off your rate each month goes a long way. Get a quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National annual average insurance savings by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2020 and May 2021. Potential savings will vary. Discounts vary and are not available in all states and situations.
From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Letson. The House Select Committee's investigation into the January 6th attack on the Capitol continues, and so do the hearings. Last month's ended with stunning testimony about what supporters of Donald Trump did behind the scenes to try and overturn the 2020 election. Some of them apparently knew they were breaking the law.
Ms. Hutchinson, did Rudy Giuliani ever suggest that he was interested in receiving a presidential pardon related to January 6th?
He did.
Giuliani and others allegedly asked President Trump to grant them pardons. One of the people interviewed by investigators was Cassidy Hutchinson, a former aide to Trump's chief of staff.
Did you hear that Mr. Trump at one point wanted to add language about pardoning those who took part in the January 6th riot?
I did hear that, and I understand that Mr. Meadows was encouraging that language as well.
In all, witnesses told the committee that 6 Republican members of Congress, former White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows, and other members of Trump's inner circle asked for pardons to shield themselves from prosecution. And they probably thought they stood a good chance of getting pardoned because of the way Trump used that power during his years in office. Today, we're bringing back a show that looks at this presidential power and how it's been used. Article 2, Section 2, Clause 1 of the Constitution says, "And he shall have power to grant reprieves and pardons for offenses against the United States, except in cases of impeachment." Those 21 words are what this show is all about. In today's English, granting clemency can mean one of two things. There's a pardon which shields someone from prosecution or wipes their criminal record clean. They get their civil rights back, the right to vote, they can get business licenses, and even own a firearm. Then there's a commutation of sentence, where the president lets you out of prison, but you still have a criminal record. President Trump used the clemency power 238 times, and many of those cases were controversial.
The president has decided to pardon Sheriff Joe Arpaio of Arizona. The court held him in criminal contempt for violating a judge's order in a racial profiling case and for continuing to target immigrants in terms of traffic stops.
And in 2018,
from the president this morning,
Trump even tweeted
that he has the, quote, absolute right to pardon himself. He goes on to write,
bucking the system and using pardons as bargaining chips. This may feel like new territory, but it all sounds familiar to historian Ken Hughes, an expert on presidential abuses of power at the University of Virginia's Miller Center.
Nixon was using the pardon power during Watergate and during the Watergate cover-up as a tool of expanding his own political power.
The burglars broke through a fire escape door that led to the committee's offices.
Democratic officials today held a series of meetings to talk about tighter security.
For Ken Hughes, what's happening today stirs up memories of Richard Nixon and Watergate.
I always try to get past the Watergate break-in as quickly as possible because it's just the tip of the iceberg.
The tip of the iceberg that ultimately revealed how Nixon was involved in political conspiracy, sabotage, and obstruction of justice. A lot of the evidence came from the famous Nixon tapes.
Richard Nixon was cursed and blessed with kind of omnipresent taping in the Oval Office and various other White House locations.
Nixon's secret recordings were a goldmine for the House Judiciary Committee, which used some of them to build an obstruction of justice case against the president. But Ken was convinced he could find even more examples of abuses of power. So when the National Archives released the tape in bulk, he did some digging. This is Conversation 437-19. It's hard to hear, but it's a pardons bombshell. It's 1973, and Nixon is talking to White House Chief of Staff H.R. Haldeman. The Watergate cover-up is collapsing, and the president is trying to shield himself. In one part, Nixon says, "There's nothing more important than to keep me in this effing office."
There's nothing more important than you and John have than to keep me in this office.
The ace up Nixon's sleeve is the pardon power. Nixon tells Haldeman that if he can bury the trail connecting him to Watergate, it's pardons all around. He says, "I don't give a what comes out on you. There's going to be a total pardon."
Now, this promise, which I found back in the 1990s when I was going through the tapes on my own, had never come to light during the Watergate hearings. And it would have been all by itself an impeachable offense.
What is Nixon telling his staff and the people that may have committed illegal acts about pardons? What is he talking to them about?
The president was telling his top aides, who are also his co-conspirators in obstruction of justice, that they could commit perjury before the Senate Watergate Committee and count on a pardon from the president. He was basically abusing his pardon power, perverting his pardon power, as a get-out-of-jail-free card, a way to put himself above the law.
With Trump, it was no secret that pardons were openly talked about for key people who might come under questioning. Here's Trump's lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, being interviewed on CNN in 2018.
You said, "I think this may get cleaned up, this probe, with a few pardons."
These things get cleaned up. Ford did it, Reagan did it, Carter did it, Clinton did it, and Bush did it in political investigations.
So you're saying after the probe is over, it may be cleaned up with any pardons?
If people were unfairly prosecuted.
In Richard Nixon's case, he never got to grant those pardons. A year after that conversation with his chief of staff, his presidency was crumbling.
There had been a vote by the grand jury to characterize Nixon as an unindicted co-conspirator in obstruction of justice.
Dan Coble is a professor of law at Capital University in Ohio. Dan says, in the final days of Nixon's presidency, White House aides are starting to think about the president's exit strategy. This is when Nixon goes from being the person who grants pardons to someone who could benefit from one. The first mention of a pardon for Nixon comes on August 1st, when Secretary of State Al Haig calls a meeting with the Vice President Gerald Ford.
Now, you have to remember, this is Ford as Vice President, who has no role in pardons at all. And so he's got Haig giving him a handwritten document that says that a president can pardon prior to indictment in the federal system.
Haig spells out a few options, and he tells Ford that the president could pardon himself or be pardoned by his successor. Ford is surprised by this, and for good reason. It's the first time a U.S. president has ever tested the waters of pardoning himself. But it never comes to that. Instead, on August 8th, 1974.
"Good evening. This is the 37th time I have spoken to you from this office."
Facing possible impeachment, Richard Nixon resigns.
"Therefore, I shall resign the presidency effective at noon tomorrow. Vice President Ford will be sworn in as president at that hour in this office."
Ford becomes president, and he's eager to put Nixon behind him.
"My fellow Americans, our long national nightmare is over."
He wants to get to work on problems his administration has inherited: unemployment, high inflation, and a domestic energy crisis. But the country is still obsessed with Watergate, and the public wants to know what will happen to Nixon. Almost a month into his presidency, Ford does what he never imagined doing.
"Serious allegations and accusations hang like a sword over our former president's head."
He pardons Nixon.
"To the pardon power conferred upon me by the Constitution, have granted, and by these presents do grant, a full, free, and absolute pardon unto Richard Nixon for all offenses against the United States, which he..."
Years later, as a law professor writing about clemency, Dan saw this move as the most constitutionally significant pardon in U.S. history. And he thought, wouldn't it be cool to ask Ford why, in the end, he decided to do it?
Hello.
Good afternoon, President Ford. This is Dan Coble, professor at Capital Law School.
This is the first time this 2001 interview has ever been made public.
Yes, nice talking to you, Dan.
Nice talking to you. Thank you.
Ford says when he first came into office, he wasn't leaning towards pardoning Nixon. Then came his first presidential press conference on August 28, 1974.
Please sit down. Good afternoon. At the outset, I have a very...
He felt that the country had a number of significant economic problems, foreign policy problems.
Would you use your pardon authority if necessary?
And yet the only questions that the press seemed to be interested in his view, pertain to what will happen to Richard Nixon.
May I just follow up on Helen's question? Are you saying, sir, that the option of a pardon for former President Nixon is still an option that you will consider depending on what the courts will do?
Of course. I make the final decision.
Well, as I returned from that press conference where I was convinced that the only way to solve the problem was to think about granting a pardon.
And that's your first press conference where you had several pardon questions, I
believe. I had many pardon questions.
Yeah.
And so I went back to the Oval Office, and as I recall, I asked Phil Buchan.
Phil Buchan was the chief White House lawyer.
To explore my authority in the first place. And to report back to me, because I was very frank, I was considering the possibility, providing it would achieve what I thought was necessary, getting Mr. Nixon's problems off my desk.
So that press conference really triggered your realistic consideration of it right off the bat, huh?
Absolutely. I was dismayed that the press was so preoccupied with that I could visualize that every press conference that followed for the next X number of months would be the same. And I thought that was unfortunate from the country's point of view.
Ford was in a bind. The public wanted a resolution. Nixon was threatening to plead not guilty if he was prosecuted, promising to drag a messy trial through the courts.
President Gerald R. Ford summoned newsmen to the White House suddenly this Sunday morning and announced that he was granting a full, free, and absolute pardon to former President Richard M. Nixon.
Now, you've been quoted as calling the pardon decision the most difficult of my life ever.
I had a visceral feeling that the public animosity to Mr. Nixon was so great that there would be a lack of understanding. And the truth is, that's the way it turned out. The public and many leaders, including dear friends, didn't understand it at the time.
His very dear friend, who had been his press secretary for years, resigned when he granted the pardon to Nixon. He asked him not to resign, but the day that he did that, he said, "I cannot work for you any longer." And he resigned. And that was a huge personal loss to Ford. So he got tremendous pushback, I think, for having granted the pardon.
Do you think he expected that? I mean, it's such a controversial decision, even looking back now. I mean, did Ford understand the consequences of that decision?
He knew that there were so many people who hated Richard Nixon who would never forgive him for pardoning him. He suggested that he wanted to grant the pardon quickly because it was like ripping a bandage off a wound. Better to do it quickly and get the pain out at once rather than do it slowly or drag it out.
And the outcry wasn't because of the pardon alone.
I was criticized that I didn't get an admission by President Nixon that he was in error and so forth.
But Ford didn't look at it that way.
One of the very interesting personal facts about Ford is that he, for the rest of his life, kept in his wallet a page from an opinion of the Supreme Court in a case called Burdick versus United States.
I have the card in my pocket, which I carry with me. Let me try to find it here.
Is that the Burdick case?
The justices found that a pardon, quote, carries an imputation of guilt, comma, acceptance, comma, a confession of it, end quote.
Mm-hmm.
So whether Nixon agreed to the pardon, the fact that he accepted it is a confession.
I ultimately came away from my interview with him convinced that he had acted out of principle. He did what he believed was best for the country, as opposed to best for himself. And in fact, the fact that critics who had said that he had done the wrong thing with Nixon, in retrospect, had changed their mind and said that Ford had done the right thing for the country.
Were you ever worried that maybe Nixon had done anything else that you didn't know about that you'd be pardoning him for?
That was plenty.
That's wonderful. So that was enough, then, in other words.
Enough obstruction of justice. That was ample.
Dan's interview with President Ford is from 2001. Ford passed away 5 years later at the age of 93. Fast forward to today, and another congressional hearing into the actions of a president and his inner circle, and talk of pardons for those who may have broken the law.
I think there are a number of similarities, and I think it's a valid comparison.
Beyond the high-profile pardons that make headlines are thousands of people who officially filed for clemency and are waiting in a very long line.
What is it that we're sitting in here for, just rotting away, wasting tax money? You know, when we can be out working and doing the things that we're supposed to be doing.
When we come back, how the pardon system broke down. You're listening to Reveal.
Hey, I'm Stephen Johnson, the new host of the TED Interview Podcast. In each episode, I'm going deep with the most fascinating thinkers on the planet and grappling with the most provocative ideas of our time. I'll talk dark matter with theoretical physicist Chanda Prescott-Weinstein, explore gaming and fiction with Pulitzer Prize-winning novelist Jennifer Egan, and discuss Russia and Putin with political activist and chess grandmaster Garry Kasparov. Check out the TED Interview wherever you listen.
From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Edson. Today, we're talking about clemency, the power the president has to set people free from federal prison or scrub their record clean after they've gotten out. Like we just heard, many of Trump's pardons were controversial, and we're only now learning how they may have come into play during the January 6th insurrection. But there's another story, one that doesn't make the headlines as much. It's the story of the people who were trying to get clemency from the president, folks who have gone through the official process and are waiting for answers. We brought you one of those stories when this show first aired in the summer of 2019, and it begins in the ring.
It's a summer night in 2003, and the Civic Center in Hammond, Indiana, is full of people. They're here to watch the fights.
There's a battle of Indiana. George Honeyboy Blades takes on the undefeated Charles Duke Tanner.
The bout is being broadcast on national TV, and that's a big deal for the up-and-coming boxers. Charles Duke Tanner and George Honeyboy Blades, both from Indiana, are meeting in the ring for the first time.
Duke Tanner in the red trunks. He is unbeaten at 17-0. Everywhere his entourage goes, you can hear him chanting, "Who's got next?" His nickname slash slogan is, "I got next."
The two men enter the ring and touch gloves. Honeyboy is smaller. He dances around at a frenetic pace. Duke looks rooted, solid in his stance. He snaps out his left jab over and over. The punches come incredibly fast.
Tanner snapping back Blade's head with that jab.
Then Duke explodes into motion, delivering body shots and combinations. Duke catches him with a solid right, then chases Blades, raining down big punches. It looks like he's going for the knockout.
Blades looks to be in trouble. Let's see if he can...
But Blades doesn't go down. And by the ninth round, they both look gassed. They're holding on to each other, winded, dripping with sweat. The fight goes a full 10 rounds. And in the end...
Your winner, Charles Duke. I got next, Tanner.
The decision goes to Duke.
It's been 19 years since that fight, and Charles Duke Tanner has spent most of that time in federal prison.
This call is from
Charles Tanner,
an inmate at a federal prison. This call is being recorded and is subject to monitoring. Hang up to decline the call or to accept, dial 5 now.
Hey, Duke, how you doing?
Oh, man, another blessed day, man. Another day closer to coming home.
A lot was going on around the time of that fight. Duke was 23 years old, a hometown hero from Gary, Indiana. He came up through the Police Athletic League's boxing program and the Golden Gloves. He went on to a 19-0 professional career.
It was the best moment of my life, but I was also in so much with trying to get my family and my friends. And, you know, I got caught up into the crime life trying to save everybody.
Duke was involved in drug trafficking, and he got caught in a sting by the Gang Response Investigative Team, a state and federal task force. They accused Duke of running a criminal organization called the Renegades that sold crack, powder cocaine, and marijuana.
I was found guilty by a jury. They gave me a life sentence for it. I had life without parole. My only way home was, my only way home before would have been in a casket.
Duke got two life sentences without the possibility of parole. Duke's arrest back in 2004 and his two life sentences were part of America's war on drugs.
Drugs are menacing our society,
which was launched by Ronald Reagan in the 1980s.
They're threatening our values and undercutting our institutions. They're killing our children.
Congress passed a bunch of tough-on-crime bills, like the Anti-Drug Abuse Act.
Last year alone, over 10,000 drug criminals were convicted, and nearly $250 million of their assets were seized by the DEA.
New sentencing guidelines and mandatory minimums put first-time offenders away for decades, and there was nothing judges could do about it, even if they thought the sentence was too harsh. Then came the Crime Bill of 1994.
When this bill is law, three strikes and you're out will be the law of the land. The penalty for killing a law enforcement officer will be death.
Three strikes laws added a lot of nonviolent drug offenders to the growing federal prison population. So let me sum it up. When Ronald Reagan took office, there were about 26,000 people in federal prison. Today, there are more than 150,000. And African Americans are 20 times more likely to be sentenced to life without parole for a nonviolent crime than white convicts. Mark Osler thinks drug sentencing laws from that era were unfair.
I was a federal prosecutor in Detroit from 1995 to 2000, which meant that I did a lot of crack cases. And after a while, I stopped believing in the sentences that we were getting. There was the 100-to-1 ratio back then between crack and powder cocaine that created incredibly long sentences for crack.
Mark stopped being a prosecutor and started fighting sentencing laws. He took it all the way to the Supreme Court.
Specifically, working to change that ratio of 100-to-1 in crack sentencing. And we won. In 2009, I won a case in the Supreme Court, United States versus Spears. The Supreme Court held that sentencing judges could categorically reject that ratio.
The next year, Congress changed the law so that sentences for crack cocaine were more in line with powder cocaine, but it didn't apply to people who had already been convicted.
And that's how I got interested in clemency, is looking for a way to make that new law apply to people who were rotting away in prison over a sentencing rule that was now gone.
And it wasn't just the sentencing. It was the way the drug war led to mass incarceration and how it disproportionately affected African-American men. In Duke Tanner's case, he got life, even though it was his first offense and it was nonviolent. Is a guy like Charles Duke Tanner, who the framers of the Constitution had in mind when they put together the pardon power in the first place? I mean, who do you think it was made for?
I think it was made for exceptional circumstances, either broadly or individually. It was kind of a social safety valve in a way that if something felt unfair, that it was a way of addressing that unfairness, whether it was one person or many.
The case against Duke and the Renegades was built with the cooperation of an informant who had been caught with drugs and a gun. That man wore a wire and set up a phony drug deal. He showed up with a duffel bag and cooler filled with fake cocaine. As soon as Duke took the containers and put them in the back of his girlfriend's Grand Am, his life changed forever. All of that to say, for Charles Duke Tanner, who was sentenced to life in federal prison, there's only one person in the world with the power to get him out. At the time we spoke, Donald Trump was still president. What would you say to the president if you could talk to him directly?
If I could talk to President Trump, just tell him I'm seeking this clemency based off of change, hope, and the possibilities of making America great again. Like me, I feel still young. Even though I'm 38 years old, I plan on fighting again. But me, just to be able to lace the gloves up again, I won a championship of life. You know what I mean? And to share that back with other kids that's coming up and not make the mistakes that I did and do the things that I've done that landed me in federal prison.
So tell me, how many times have you applied for presidential clemency?
I applied October 2014, and I did a new one just this October of 2018 that's pending right now.
There's a system that's been in place for 130 years to process clemency requests like Duke's. It's called the Pardon Attorney's Office, and it's a part of the Department of Justice. They make recommendations to the White House. It's where Duke's application went first. Sam Morrison is a lawyer who worked in that office for 13 years.
It's a matter of trying to look at the whole person.
Sam used to review applications. Now, he represents clients trying to get clemency.
The criteria in general would be things like, one, what is the nature of the offense? How serious was it? Was there a victim? How long ago did it occur? What, if any, other criminal record does the applicant have? All those things go into the mix.
Duke seems to fit the criteria. He's a nonviolent first-time offender. He completed over 1,000 hours of educational programs in prison. He mentored other prisoners. Duke gathered 81,000 signatures on a petition and a letter of support from the mayor of his hometown, Gary, Indiana. All these factors should work in his favor with the lawyers at the Justice Department.
Because if you can convince them that you are not a risk to recidivate and that you have the right attitude, that you accept responsibility for what you did and so on, and they give you a favorable recommendation, well, that's all the president typically is going to know about the case. And so you're very likely to get a pardon.
That's how it's supposed to work. But if you go to the Department of Justice website and count the clemency petitions that are waiting for answers, there are more than 16,000 of them waiting for a yes or no.
Most of that backlog comes from the Obama administration, and in a few minutes, we're going to explain how that happened. For now, what you need to know is that is a record-breaking number, a crazy number. When President Reagan took office, only about 500 people were waiting for an answer on their clemency requests. Now, we're over 16,000. What does that mean for the people behind bars who are waiting?
I have rehabilitated. I have done everything that my sentencing judge told me to do when he gave me a death sentence. I've done it and even more. What is it that we're sitting in here for, just rotting away, wasting tax money, you know, when we can be out working and doing the things that we're supposed to be doing? Like, I'm asking for the president to give me a clemency and commute my sentence and let me go home, you know what I mean, and be a productive citizen. That's the best way that I see fit for me.
In 2016, Duke's sentence was reduced to 30 years after changes were made to federal sentencing guidelines. But he still had nearly 12 years left to serve. For Duke and thousands of others locked up in federal prison, the chance of presidential clemency provides a ray of hope.
I have to sleep this night, but I stay in prayer. You know what I mean? Actually, right now, I'm fasting right now anyway. So we're just praying. We're just praying and waiting. You know, I got...
And just like that, his phone call is cut off. Praying and waiting. There's not much else he can do at this point. But there are other people who are trying to do something.
I've got so many who have double life sentences for a first offense. And that should be the biggest red flag of all for a society. And clemency is really the only thing that can correct a huge problem on a big scale.
You're listening to Reveal.
Hello, listener. My name is Najib Amini, and I am a producer here at Reveal. Reveal is a nonprofit news organization, and we depend on support from our listeners, listeners like you. Donate today at revealnews.org/donate. It helps fund the stories that we tell and helps me feed my cat. So thank you.
From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Letson. Today, we're talking about presidential clemency. When we first aired this show back in 2019, Charles Duke Tanner, a former pro boxer, was serving a 30-year sentence in federal prison for a nonviolent first-time drug offense. He filed a petition with the pardon attorney's office and was waiting, like thousands of others, for news from the president. And there were a lot of people rooting for Duke Tanner, including Amy Pova.
We've sent in the clemency petition, as you know, and then the supplemental.
She's on the phone with Duke right now. He calls her often from prison. Amy helped Duke file his most recent application for clemency.
And so you're anticipating a return, a big return of Duke Tanner, light heavyweight boxer, back in the ring.
Yes, yes, for sure.
Well, I better have a front row seat.
Oh, yeah, come on. Actually, you're gonna be the one. You're gonna be the one walking out with me when I come out. When we come out.
Oh, well, I can't wait.
We're inside Amy's dining room on an overcast day in Malibu, California. It's her makeshift office, covered with stacks of paper, boxes full of letters from prisoners and their supporters. Amy runs a volunteer nonprofit called the Can Do Clemency Foundation. She started it to help women serving life sentences for nonviolent drug crimes. Now she's helping men get clemency too, nonviolent drug offenders like Duke. Over the years, she's helped a lot of people. She's worked with them to fill out petitions, collect letters of support. She's even held vigils in front of the White House.
Josephine Legazma, she is an absolute sweetheart. She volunteers in the chapel. She's serving life without parole.
In this video from YouTube, Amy's standing in front of the White House holding a big blow-up photo of a woman named Josephine Ledesma. Amy calls her Josie. In the picture, Josie is wearing a maroon cap and gown from one of the many programs she completed in prison.
She's already served over 20 years. She's been in since 1992. It's time to reunite her. Her children are small.
Now, her kids have kids. Josie's got 10 grandchildren. Just like Duke, Josie was sentenced to life in prison for drug trafficking. It was her first offense, a nonviolent crime. Josie and Duke are two of the dozens of people Amy is working with to get clemency.
I've got so many who have double life sentences, life sentences for a first offense. And that should be the biggest red flag of all for a society. And clemency is really the only thing that can correct a huge problem on a big scale. People come out of prison every single day who have committed murder or arson or bank robbery or all kinds of different crimes, who get less time than a lot of people serving life for pot, and they've got more time than somebody who has priors and has raped and even killed somebody.
Most of the people she's helping are in prison because of the war on drugs. When it started in the 1980s, about 30,000 people were in federal prisons. By President Obama's first year in office, that number had ballooned to more than 200,000. Obama saw this as a problem, so in 2014, he started something called the Clemency Project.
It does not make sense for a nonviolent drug offender to be getting 20 years, 30 years, in some cases life, imprisonment.
The Clemency Project was designed to get nonviolent, first-time drug offenders out of prison after they paid their debt to society.
By exercising these presidential powers, I have the chance to show people what a second chance can look like.
Under the program, Obama did let a lot of people out of prison. He gave out 1,715 commutations of sentence, compared to George W. Bush, who only gave out 11. But even with the Clemency Project, a lot of people who met the criteria were not released.
Very early on, I started seeing perfect candidates getting denied. Women who were first offenders, who were minor participants. And right then, I was just like, oh, this is not going well.
It was kind of hit or miss.
That's Sam Morrison, who we heard from earlier. He worked in the pardon attorney's office from 1997 to 2010.
He granted, it was 1,700 and something commutations. That's a big number, but not in comparison to the size of the federal prison population. It's not a big number. He could easily have granted 20,000, not 1,700. It's a drop in the bucket compared to the number of people who, on the face of it, qualified.
One of the cases that was rejected was the boxer, Charles Duke Tanner.
I had been down 10 years, and I had clear conduct. It was a nonviolent crime, my first arrest in my life. So my case manager was like, hey, this is for you. You know, let's push for this. So we put it in, and September of 16, I got denied. They didn't give me a reason why. They just said denied, and you have 1 year to follow up. Now, my only co-defendant who went to trial with me got granted clemency. So, you know, it was a big pill to swallow for me on that one.
Why do you think you were denied if your co-defendant actually got it?
I mean, I don't know. Actually, my co-defendant, well, he wasn't a first-time offender. But he got it, and he's home now, thankful. I mean, I watched a lot of people get it. And they didn't fit all of the prongs, but they got granted clemency somehow.
The chaos of Clemency Project 2014, who got help and who didn't, it was frustrating for a lot of people, including the pardon attorney at the time, Deborah Leff. She resigned in 2016. She wrote a letter saying her office was underfunded and understaffed and that the White House lawyers weren't taking her recommendations.
She simply wasn't given the resources to do what she ostensibly was supposed to be doing. So she got frustrated and said, I'm not going to do this anymore.
After Deborah Leff resigned, there was no pardon attorney until Elizabeth Oyer was appointed this April.
That means for 6 years, there were just a series of acting pardon attorneys whose recommendations were mostly ignored by the White House.
If the White House is ignoring the recommendations of the pardon attorney's office, what's the point of having one? I mean, are we just burning taxpayer money? They wouldn't give us an interview. It's kind of a black box.
Yeah, that's intentional. They want it to be a black box. But, I mean, you're right. It's kind of a pointless exercise.
So where are all the petitions that are waiting on decisions from the president? Are they sitting in a drawer somewhere in the White House?
It doesn't mean that they're all yet at the White House. So those cases are all going to be at one stage or another of the investigation process. Eventually, a recommendation will be written in each one, and it will make its way to the White House. But it doesn't mean they're all there yet. And I can't tell you, and the Justice Department won't tell you, where all those cases are at any particular time. So we don't know how many of those are at the White House right now.
Amy Pova knows what it's like to ask for clemency and to wait while a petition works its way through the system. That's because, as a young woman, she was sentenced to 24 years in federal prison for conspiracy to traffic narcotics.
With conspiracy, even if you don't sell it, even if you don't import it, if you're associated with somebody who does, the conspiracy law, that's the trigger word.
In Amy's case, her ex-husband ran an ecstasy operation, manufacturing millions of pills of the party drug. Now, he was caught in the early 90s and cooperated with law enforcement, and he only got 4 years in prison. Amy, on the other hand, was not directly involved with the drug business. But after her husband was arrested, she collected some of the drug money. She did not cooperate with the FBI and got sentenced to 24 years. Amy was sent to FCI Dublin, a federal prison in Northern California. She remembers a phone call with her mother not long after she got there.
I was crying. I said, I just remember almost screaming. I was like, I'm in prison.
After 9 years behind bars, Amy gets called into her case manager's office. As she makes her way through the prison, she fears the worst.
So I just kept thinking, oh my God, you know, what could have gone wrong? Maybe mom and dad, maybe something's wrong with them.
Her case manager was frazzled.
She said, I need you to sit down. I've got to set you up on probation. I've got to do this. I've got to do that. I've got to make an airplane reservation for you. And I said, why? And she just looked at me and she said, you're going home. And those three words. And I was just like, what? And she said, finally, she said, you received clemency and I have to have you out of here by 5 o'clock. So she kept telling me to sit down and I would sit down and then I would pop out of my chair like a jack in the box.
Amy's sentence was commuted by President Bill Clinton in 2000. She had put in an application a few years earlier. And after nearly a decade, Amy was suddenly free.
So it says, to all to whom these presents shall come, greeting.
She's so reading formal. From the actual signed clemency document. It's what you'd expect from such a grand declaration of freedom. Faded cream-colored paper, signature in black ink, a gold seal. Presidential clemency petitions are something Amy's gotten very familiar with over the years, both in prison and after she was freed as an advocate for other people trying to get one. Amy thinks Duke Tanner has a strong case for clemency. They talk a lot, sometimes twice a day.
And for Trump to give it to me, it really shocked the world, I think.
Well, not to mention the
It's Thursday afternoon, and there is a lot going on at Amy's.
You're not going to believe this. Oh, but now he's got, I shouldn't have taken your call because Josie's arriving.
Their phone call is interrupted. Amy's got a visitor. She heads to the back door and walks down a few steps.
Oh my goodness. Look at you.
Look at you. You're
beautiful.
Oh my God. We made it.
We made it. You're so right. Oh my goodness.
It's Josie Ledesma, the woman Amy was trying to get out of prison at the White House vigil. The last time they saw each other, they were serving time together in a federal prison around 2 decades ago.
Gosh.
Here, go ahead, sweetie.
This is beautiful. Oh, my goodness.
Wasn't it fun to be able to drive now?
Yes, especially out here. I'm like, oh, my God. I didn't know this existed. It's gorgeous.
Well, you're welcome anytime.
Thank you.
Josie was released by President Obama after 24 years behind bars.
Oh, God.
Oh, my God. It's so nice to see you.
What a journey.
Yes, definitely. Definitely.
The two women walk inside and sit at Amy's kitchen table. Posters with faces of prisoners lean against the wall. Amy and Josie are two of the lucky ones. Most people who apply don't get clemency.
It's awesome to be home, to be out, to be able to drive and feel the air hit my face and be able to just see freedom. But one of my pains is that I still have people in there that I love, sisters, people that I grew up with that are still in there. I think they deserve a chance to come home also.
A chance to come home. That's what Amy and Josie want for the nonviolent prisoners of the war on drugs, people like Duke. His son, Charles III, was just 2 years old when Duke got locked up.
Hello, President Trump. I would like to ask you to please release my dad from prison.
This is a video Duke's son made and posted to YouTube in 2019.
I know that he made a huge mistake, and he really looks back on his mistake and regrets it, and I feel like he'll never do it again. My dad's been in my life ever since I was young. We have a great relationship. He's been helping me every step of the way. He helps me and my friends. He taught me right from wrong. I would just please want you to release my father from prison. Thank you.
What has it been like being apart from him and not being able to be there as he grows up?
That's the worst. That's the worst thing that I lost. You know, being there to physically be there for him, to teach him how to tie a shoe, you know, to teach him how to drive, and to see him in his sports, and, you know, just teaching him how to be a man, you know. But I didn't let prison stop it. We have a beautiful relationship, but to be there with him, you know, and to get him ready to send off to college and become a real man. And,
yeah.
I need to be there in his presence to show him, even though I showed him so much from inside these walls.
So that's where we left it, back in the summer of 2019, which seems like forever ago. A little over a year goes by, we don't hear much from Duke, and then something unexpected.
An ex-boxer from Gary, Indiana, serving life in prison is now instead a free man.
The president granted him clemency.
On the 21st of October 2020, President Trump commuted Duke's sentence. Duke walked out of prison in Pennsylvania that same day. The next morning, Reveal producer Michael Schiller caught up with Duke on the phone. He was at the airport in Philadelphia waiting for a flight home.
What's up, Mike?
Duke.
What's going on, Mike?
Duke.
Man, listen, man, it finally came, brother.
Oh, man, I'm so happy for you. That's wonderful, wonderful. How you feeling?
Right now, man, I feel great, man. I'm sitting next to my son.
Oh, wow.
You know, so it's just a great feeling, man. You know, that's what really made me know it was real once I saw him. You know, I got to embrace him and hug him as long as I wanted to. I got to drop some tears, man. I've been trying to cry for 16 years, and they wouldn't come out.
So why Duke Tanner, out of the more than 16,000 people waiting? The pardon attorney's office didn't respond when we asked. Duke credits Amy Pova and other supporters for getting the attention of the White House. We know he was one of 5 nonviolent offenders serving long sentences who were released that day. It was less than 2 weeks before the election. A video of Duke reuniting with his son ended up in a campaign ad for Trump.
This moment was 16 years in the making. Charles Duke Tanner embracing his 18-year-old son.
A few weeks later, I checked in with Duke just to see how he's adjusting to life. Man, it's good to see you in the flesh via Zoom.
I'm happy to be here.
How does it feel to come home? Like, what did that feel like?
I mean, I was just actually having a conversation about
my freedom. And it was just like, some people like feel like it's not real, but I feel it's real. I know I'm here. I'm free.
Can you walk me through it? What happened?
So I'm just sitting in my cell waiting for the count to clear. And my case manager, him and a couple of other officers came and he said, hey, we need to talk to you in the back. So I walked to the back and the guy say, we got to get you out of here. I say, get me out of here. Where I'm going. And he said, the president signed off on your clemency a couple hours ago and you get an immediate release and you can't even go back to your cell because, you know, supposed to be here. And once again, you know, I would start praying and I was sweating. And next thing you know, I was in the hotel free.
So how is it being back with your son?
Oh, it's a beautiful thing. You know, it's like he's been driving me around, you know, but he's in college. So it's about an hour and a half away. But he comes home and on the weekend and we get to spend time together. And we still learning each other. We having fun. You know, I asked him, you know, I said, I'm getting on your nerve. I said, no, Dad, you're not getting on my nerves. So, you know, I call him early in the morning. I'm still on prison time. I wake up at 5:30. Now I get a phone. I call him, wake him up. He said, Dad, I don't go to class till like 3 hours later. But, you know, I just get to see him, you know.
Yeah.
He's still, so it's a beautiful thing.
Our lead producer for this week's show was Michael I. Schiller. The Nixon Ford segment was produced by Anna Hamilton. DocuTelenetis edited the show. Thanks to Melissa Lewis for help with the data, to associate producer Najib Amini, and to our production manager, Amy Mustafa. Victoria Baranetsky is our general counsel. Original score and sound design by the dynamic duo, Jay Breezy, Mr. Jim Briggs, and Fernando, my man, Yo Aruda. They had help this week from Brett Simpson and Catherine Steyer Martinez. Our digital producer is Sarah Merck. Our CEO is Kezar Campwala. Sumi Agarwal is our editor-in-chief. Our theme music is by Camerato, Lightning. Support for Reveals provided by the Reeve and David Logan Foundation, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Jonathan Logan Family Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Heising Simons Foundation, the Hellman Foundation, the Democracy Fund, and the In As Much Foundation. Reveal is a co-production of the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX. I'm Al Ledson. And remember, there is always more to the story.